We'll call committee to order. And this morning we're going to go through a House staff research on income and sales tax expenditures. Fiscal staff got a whole crew, so page 33 of the handout that we received seems like it was just many days ago, but yesterday, 2 days ago. And I'm not sure who was up at the time. Michael, Ms. Anzi.
Mr. Chair, I believe we left off on Monday on page 33 of your handout. And in the interest of time, we can skip pages 33 through page 35. Because these are federal subtractions. So that brings us to page 36, the job fees income subtraction. This is a subtraction from federal taxable income for net income from the operation of a qualified business in a designated job fee zone. This subtraction is allowed for 12 years, which is the maximum duration of the zone. In fiscal 08, the revenue loss is $3.2 million from this subtraction. We do not know the number of returns that benefited from this provision, but we do know that, according to Deed, there were about 328 business or job deed business subsidy agreements. And we know that the average revenue loss per business is about $70,000, but we don't know how much of that revenue loss can be attributed to income tax, this subtraction. And now I think Mr. Michael will describe the rest.
Michael? Going over the objective or rationale for this, I think is pretty obvious that the goal is to stimulate new economic activity in these zones. In terms of related direct spending programs, obviously the state has a number of economic development programs and business investment programs that operate through the Department of Employment and Economic Development, such as the Minnesota Investment Fund. If you look at the graph, you will see, I don't know how much to interpret into this graph because of the small subset of returns that it's based upon, but you can see that the tax benefit is concentrated over on the right-hand side of the graph. But the reason that there's a little bit of fear about whether, how large the sample is when you look and you see that in a couple of the deciles there's nothing, and then lower deciles there is some, that sort of suggests it's not a big enough sample maybe to make too many inferences, other than the fact that it does tend to be concentrated on in the higher income levels. In terms of effectiveness, I guess the only thing we can say is the legislative auditor did a program evaluation back in 2007, which was presented to the committee, and we don't really have anything to add to that.
On page 38 of your handout, the job credit. This is a refundable credit allowed against individual income tax for a qualified business located in a job Z zone. The credit is 7% of the increase in payroll since the designation of the zone for jobs paying more than $30,000. The estimated revenue loss in fiscal 08 is $800,000, and again, the number of returns that benefited from this provision is unknown, but again, we know that there are 328 job Z business subsidy agreements, and the average revenue loss per business in a job Z zone is about $70,000, but again, we don't know of that amount how much is, can be attributed to this job credit.
And in terms of the objective, I think it's pretty clear that the rationale here is a little bit narrower than the general job Z provision, and that's it's trying to encourage higher paying jobs to be located in those zones. And effectively what this does is to rebate the individual income tax that those employees pay back to their employers on the portion of their income over $30,000 and under $100,000. The one thing that the description does not say is that it's capped at $100,000 per employee. In terms of the effectiveness, there are some national studies. There's a bunch of national studies of these enterprise zone style programs that have mixed evidence, but on the jobs credit, there's a little more evidence that it actually can have an effect on unemployment.
The next credit, Mr. Chair, is the marriage credit. And this is a non-refundable credit allowed against individual income tax for a married couple filing a joint return if both spouses have earned income or taxable pension or taxable Social Security, and their situation results in a marriage penalty due to the size of the income tax bracket. In fiscal 08, the estimated revenue loss is $58.6 million, and 383 returns claim this credit for tax year 2006.
This credit was enacted in 1990.
Just a minute. I was going to really get a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I can I go back to the job fees? Mr. Michael, you mentioned that it's not capped at
$100,000? Yes.
Is that something that the legislative auditor's report, are there suggestions that came out in the legislative auditor's report, and was that one of them? Do you know?
Mr. Michael? Mr. Chairman, Representative Rude, no, that the cap at $100,000 was a feature of the original bill and has been in place ever since the program was enacted. And the thought behind that was, for example, if you'd have the circumstance where you're paying an employee, including perhaps the owner of the business, you know, several hundred thousand dollars, they didn't want to rebate the tax on the amount over $100,000 back to the business. So it was intended to just sort of put an upper limit on that. And so essentially it sort of provides an incentive for jobs that pay more than $30,000 but not on the portion above $100,000. So you can pay somebody $200,000 but you only get the 7% back on the amount that's the difference between $100,000 and $30,000.
Ms. Danzy? Ms. Danzy, before you go, I think we have quorum now, and Vice Chair Reinert was approved minutes. Is ready to move the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reinert. Minutes moved. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay? Minutes are approved. Thank you, Ms. Danzy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the marriage credit was enacted in 1999 to offset marriage penalties implicit in the state's rate and bracket system. It initially applied just to wage and self-employment income and then was expanded to include taxable pension income and taxable Social Security income, which could easily be identified as pertaining to one spouse's or the other spouse's employment. The graph shows where it goes in terms of population deciles, and it goes to the population deciles where there are marriage penalties in the rates and brackets. It is effective in eliminating those penalties because it's simply a mathematical formula based on what the tax would be if these people were single versus what they are as married joint. So this is one where we really can say that it meets its objective. It does not address any marriage penalties that are embedded in the federal tax system, and it does not address any marriage penalties that might result from unearned income of either spouse.
On page 41, the credit for long-term care insurance premiums. This is a credit that equals 25% of the long-term care insurance premium paid. The maximum credit is $200 for married joint filers and $100 for all other filers. The estimated revenue loss in fiscal 08 is $7.3 million, and this credit was claimed by approximately 56,000 returns in 2006.
I'm sorry, Mr. Michael. Ms. Templin, I see going forward that the number kind of flatlines. Based on how many of the baby boomers we expect to be retiring soon, is there any indication that we'll see a few more of these folks It's a little jump each year, but not, I don't think, representative of the group of people that we're going to have retiring when the baby boomers retire, and subsequently, I imagine, a few years move on to the nursing home stage.
Mr. Chair, I think that will be covered by Mr. Michael in the rest of the presentation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just to respond to respond to your question, this credit really is a function of the number of people. Because of the low cap of $100, virtually everyone who buys this insurance qualifies for the maximum credit. And so the cost is largely a function of how many people decide to buy this insurance. And so you see the slow growth is largely reflecting a projection that a few more people every year will buy this insurance. The provision was enacted in 1997, and at the time the proponents basically made the contention that the rationale for this was to encourage taxpayers to buy long-term care insurance because it would actually save the state money under the medical assistance program, Minnesota's Medicaid program. And of course, MA pays for a fairly large portion of long-term care costs for Minnesotans. Subsequent to that enactment in 97, it was expanded once to allow a slightly broader subset of insurance to qualify for it. It originally required to have inflation coverage in it, and it was amended later to take that out to make the insurance more affordable. In terms of related direct spending programs, since the credit was enacted, I think in 2006, the legislature adopted what's called a partnership program, which allows individuals who buy this insurance to essentially avoid the spend down, as I understand it, under MA on the dollar amount of the insurance coverage that pays in lieu of Medicaid. So, for example, if you have $200,000 of this type of insurance, you would be able to exempt $200,000 from the MA spend down. In terms of effectiveness, well, actually, I guess the next thing to talk about is the incidence. You can see the graph. Actually, this is pretty much neutral in terms of its progressivity, regressivity. It's just slightly benefits people of lower income, so it adds just a little bit of progressivity to the tax, I think would be the, but it's basically neutral. And that, I think, largely a function of the fact that people who study this find that the target market for this insurance tends to be neither low-income people nor very high-income people. Low-income people, it makes little sense to buy this insurance because they're going to be covered by Medicaid, by MA generally. High-income people can self-insure, so it doesn't make sense for them to buy. So the target market is sort of the middle-income folks, and that sort of economic reality is reflected in that graph. In terms of evidence as to whether this is effective, you know, given an objective of saving the state money under the MA program, there's a fairly long write-up in the handout, which I will not go through all of it. And the reason there's a lot here is because the chair had asked us to look into this, and there's been sort of a flurry of recent research by economists, because there's a bunch of interest both in this insurance and the efforts by the states and federal government to try to figure out ways to essentially reduce the public cost of providing long-term care insurance. Basically, all of this research comes to a consistent conclusion, but two consistent conclusions. One is that these incentives do work in the sense that they encourage people to buy the insurance, so they actually do change people's behavior. There's, of the four studies that are listed there, three of them found that result, the fourth one found no effect. So I think it's safe to say the consensus is that the insurance does work, the credits or the tax incentives do work to encourage people to buy insurance. But then, as to the second question, do these incentives work to actually save the states and federal government money in terms of expenditures under the Medicaid program? All of the studies find that no. Basically, the cost of the tax incentive exceeds the savings and spending under the Medicaid program. and from a, and that's true taking into account both the federal and state spending. The study that found the biggest cost savings to the government was the second study on the list, and that found basically for every dollar in tax expenditures, there was an 84 cent savings in Medicaid. But of course, the important thing from a narrow state perspective is that 50 cents of that savings went to the federal government and 34 cents went to the state. So when the state's providing an incentive that it pays for exclusively, it's enriching the federal government by 50 cents and saving itself 34 cents for every dollar it saves, assuming that this study is correct. The other two studies found smaller effects.
Mr. Michael, I think that represented that a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Michael, how do they calculate the savings when the tax incentive is for to get people to buy these contracts? And I don't see where the state or the federal government would see any savings for some time down the road, because if you buy one of these contracts at age 55 and you don't go to the nursing home until age 80, the state really hasn't saved anything. In fact, they've had a cost to provide the incentive. So how do these studies calculate the long-term savings or project what should be there? Because this is a long-term deal. This is not something that happens tomorrow.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, through the magic of econometrics, they're basically they're... I say that as a non-economist, but who some, you know, has some understanding of the, you know, the way they do these things. And in most of these two out of these studies were done using survey data that you collected. There's a regular survey that's done by the federal government, and they analyzed a variety of factors. They analyzed essentially who purchased the insurance based on this survey, you know, what their income situation was, and data on the probability of their using long-term care, the amount of their other assets to the extent that they would normally pay for the, you know, some of the long-term care themselves. And so, yeah, there's sort of a, I guess, a leap of faith to the extent to which you trust these statistical methods. But they tried to take all of that, all of those factors into account. And that's why you see the divergence in the rates of savings. But the data that they can work on is they can see when they have national data, they can compare the number of people that are buying insurance as reported in this survey in states that have the incentive or in states that don't have the incentive. And the federal government, one of the studies looked at federal incentives. The federal government enacted the itemized deduction in the 90s. And so then these researchers looked at what, because they had multi-year data, they looked at the change that resulted from that and who it impacted and so forth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Rod?
Just a quick follow-up question, Mr. Michael. Then, so do they assess the difference then between what they would have, or how do I even ask this question, between what that group of people would have cost the state without the insurance versus what they cost the state with the insurance? Is that the differential?
Mr. Michael? Madam Chair, Representative Rod, yes, that's essentially what they're attempting to measure is, and you know, they have samples where they've got people from states that don't have the incentives and people that do have, you know, states that do have the incentives. But then they're estimating, they have to estimate, because their fact is like there's a fair number of people that allow these policies to lapse. They buy them for a few years and then after a few years they allow them to lapse. So they have to adjust for those. For factors like that, but it's precisely that they're trying to estimate for each of these people how much the insurance would pay in long-term care, and secondly, how much the state Medicaid program would have paid absent that coverage. And so, they're trying to measure the difference between those two things, and the methodology is very, you know, fairly complicated, as you would guess, because it has to take into account all of those probabilities and timing differences and so forth.
Mr. Michael, does it also take into account differences between states, or is this kind of an average throughout the state? any differences in terms of the state's participation in Medicaid and things like that, or the fact that Minnesota is one of, I think, one of one or one of two states that don't have equalization in terms of private pay and things like that? Does that matter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, they did these. I mean, I'd have to go back. Two of the studies are national, whereas the one looked at differences in states. And the one that looked at differences in states tried to take into account because there's quite wide variation in the Medicaid program. Some offer very generous benefits and others do not, and some, you know, pay more for long-term care and others do not. I do not remember from that study, though, whether they took into account this equalization factor, which I know can be important. And in fact, I think that's one of the things that the surveys find, is that there's a bigger incentive to purchase the insurance in states that don't have that feature, because there's an incentive to buy it because you don't want to end up where you have a two-tiered industry. You want to, you know, there's probably for middle class people, they don't want to end up in the institutions that, you know, that the state is willing to pay for. They'd rather be in the private pay, and so that creates an incentive actually to buy the insurance that's probably not present in Minnesota, where all of the charges are equal. But I do not know whether that study actually tried to take that difference into account. I'd have to go back and look and see.
Mr. Michael, I just had a question too. This is the obviously the carrot approach. What about some of the states that have started to use the stick approach? They will give away all our assets, give away savings, bonds, whatever, stocks, and then become a ward of the state. I know there's some states that have then been looking back and saying, whether it's 5 years, 7 years. And the only reason I say it is that we had some personal experience. My grandfather owned our family farm. You know, my uncle now owns it. We purchased long-term care insurance, and right up until he passed away last November, we were still above his payments were still above his cost when he was in the final days of the nursing home. And granted, it was an agricultural situation, which is a declining number of folks. But in that case, you know, my uncle wanted to make sure he didn't have to sell the farm to pay for some of these benefits. And in North Dakota, I think they'd gone to that, kind of to that method of, we're going to go backwards and look at some of your assets, even if you did give them away 5 years ago or 7 years ago. And so the stick part of it, I don't think we don't have here yet, but if that is, that play a role at all in some of these long-term care deals?
Mr. Chair, you're way out of my realm of expertise. But from reading these studies, first of all, as I...
Madam, I'd like to mark the tape.
Now, that happens quite often. But along the same lines as I was, you know, telling Representative Broad, these studies, first of all, focus only on the tax benefits. I think states vary quite a bit as to their aggressiveness. I think federal law requires them to do some of this, but there are some states that go beyond that in terms of what the federal law requires, and they are more aggressive in preventing these transfers to impoverish yourself in order to qualify for the state Medicaid program.
Right.
These studies did not take that into account, and that's also going to affect, I think, one's willingness to buy that insurance, because if the stick is bigger it's more likely to come down on you, you would have a bigger incentive, I think, to buy this insurance. And so, again, there are just so many factors that's a limit of all of these kind of econometric studies, and I think that, you know, you point out probably one of the limitations of these.
That's why we don't do math. Representative Loft had a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of a context thing for us to think about as we look at this particular credit. I mean, we've seen really credible studies that the Department of Human Services has done that shows the majority of people who are not prepared to even pay their teeth bill after they're retired, let alone worry about long-term care insurance. And so we run into situations where people have been putting a lot of money into long-term care insurance premiums that maybe should have been putting it into a Roth IRA or a regular IRA and actually having income to dispose of. I have some concerns about how they've been marketed. There's been some pretty
there isn't always accurate information being shared with people on evaluating the risk of needing to go into long-term care insurance, and there's increasing evidence of people who pay for it during their working years, and then when they hit retirement, which is when they're more likely to need it, they drop the policies because they can't afford to sustain the policy right when they're getting to the point where they might need to collect on it. And so I think there's a whole bunch of issues here about it in general, and as we weigh the priority of various tax advantages and incentives, we need to, I think about the context.
Thank you, Sam Wofford. Mr. Michael or Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, page 45, the working family credit. This is a refundable credit that is allowed against income tax. For taxpayers who are eligible for the federal earned income tax credit, the revenue impact of fiscal 08 is estimated to be almost $175 million, and there were 265,000 returns that benefited or that claimed this credit in tax benefits.
This credit was first enacted in 1991. At the time, it was set as a percentage of the federal credit. The objective was to encourage work by providing a credit that equaled a percentage of earned income. It also helped some families lift their total income, including this credit, above the federal poverty guidelines. There are a variety of other state and federal programs that provide direct assistance to low-income families, including food stamps, housing assistance, and income assistance under MFIP, primarily for families with children. The working family credit is available to families both with and without children. It's much larger for those who have children. People without children, it largely serves to offset the Social Security and Medicare payroll tax for the very low-income range. The incidence graph shows the distribution of this credit. You see that it goes to the lower population deciles, and it adds progressivity to the individual income tax system. To the extent that the objective is to increase work efforts, there have been a number of studies that show that it generally does that overall. We have an information brief on this topic that lists those studies and goes through their findings. The credit also results in single parents who are working full-time at minimum wage having combined income and tax credits that are above the federal poverty guidelines. It moves filers without dependents toward the poverty guidelines, and married couples in which both spouses are working full-time at minimum wage are already above the poverty guidelines without the assistance of tax credits.
On page 47, the child and dependent care credit. This is a refundable income tax credit that is allowed for a portion of dependent care expenses if those expenses were necessary to hold or to look for a job. This credit, the revenue impact is about $15 million in fiscal 08 and almost 36,000 returns claimed this credit in 2006.
Minnesota's dependent care credit is targeted toward low and moderate income families. It's not available for those with incomes above about $36,000 in tax year 2009, and that amount is indexed annually for inflation. There isn't any explicit objective described in the statute, but we generally assume that it has two goals, and those are, as Ms. Templin noted, to recognize that dependent care costs are an expense of working and to encourage low and moderate income people to work. Related direct spending programs are the basic sliding fee child care program for low-income parents and also MFIT child care, which is provided not just to parents who are on MFIP, but also to parents who are MFIP eligible, choose to forego the MFIP cash grant and meet the MFIP work requirements. So since the dependent care credit itself requires you to be working or looking for work, it sort of fits together with the MFIP child care program. Those two direct spending child care programs The spending for them in fiscal 2009 combined is something over $200 million. So those are quite a bit larger in terms of total spending than the dependent care credit, which is at around $15 million per year. There's a table at the top of page 48 that shows you the maximum income for those two direct spending programs. And those are, for basic sliding fee, that's the income when you're entering the program, and then it phases down for incomes above that. So if you get on the program when your income is below that level, you can remain on it until your income rises above something higher. The incidence chart shows that this goes toward the lower deciles, and like the working family credit, it makes the tax more progressive. We aren't aware of any studies of the effectiveness of either the state or the federal credit in encouraging people to work. The average amount of expenses claimed on the credit is about $2,000 per year. So you have $2,000 of expenses, and then you get a portion of that as a credit. Low-income taxpayers must wait until they file their return to get the credit, so it's not clear that the credit really helps them to pay these expenses, because they'll be paying the expenses from January through December of the tax year, and then getting the credit issued to them as a refund or as an offset of liability when they file their return in January through April. If the objective of the credit is to recognize that expenses are a cost of earning income, then it may be a little incongruous to just target it to lower income taxpayers. That may be a function of the resources that were available when the credit was enacted, and it doesn't really match with that philosophical objective.
On page 50 of your handout, the credit for K-12 education expenses. This is a refundable income tax credit that is allowed for 75% of K-12 education-related expenses. The credit is subject to an income-based phase-out, like the child and dependent care credit that we just heard about. And the phase-out for income begins at $33,500, and this phase-out amount is not indexed. The estimated revenue loss in fiscal 08 is about $14 million, and 55,000 returns claimed this provision, or excuse me, claimed this credit in 2006.
The K-12 education credit is intended to help lower-income families provide educational opportunities for their children. As initially proposed by Governor Carlson, it would have been limited to K-12 tuition expenses. And then there was a lot of discussion about that and about this credit in the 1997 legislative session. And ultimately, it was restricted to a lot of things except tuition over constitutional concerns about providing a credit directly for tuition. At that time, also, the proponents of the credit were very interested in having it apply to computer expenses to help low-income households acquire computers for their children to use and to keep up to speed with the changes going on in the world. Since the credit was enacted, we've heard anecdotally that a number of low-income parents use it to pay for all-day kindergarten. Some school districts offer all-day kindergarten to all children in the district without any charge. Other districts offer it through their community education program, in which all students in the district get the half-day kindergarten just as a public school student. And then if they want to stay for the whole day, the parents have to pay the extra amount for the other half of the day. When it's run through community education, then parents can use the credit for those expenses. There have been several cases in districts where the district will possibly partner with a local bank to set up some sort of a revolving loan fund to help people pay for this as it goes on. Because this has the same issue that I raised with regard to the dependent care credit. These low-income households have to pay these education expenses from January through December of the calendar year, and then they don't receive the credit until they file their return in January through April, which can be a hardship for some families.
Representative Broad had a question, I believe, Ms. Templeton.
I just have a question. Related to that that credit, it includes computers, but it doesn't include Internet access. Is that correct?
Ms. Vanzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, that's correct. And the computer component of the qualifying expenses is limited to $200 per family for educational hardware and software.
I'd be interested in where somebody can get a $200 computer, maybe Taiwan, I'm not sure. But thank you very much.
Representative Garofalo.
Yeah, that's a place. Yeah, no one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Mandy, is there a Department of Revenue program where you're able to meter out anticipated credits in advance of when you actually, instead of just getting your full refund in April or May of the following tax year, where you get the tax preferences in advance? Am I not remembering this properly, or
Ms. Mandy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, probably about 10 years ago, I think the Department of Revenue proposed something they called Tax Credit Express, in which that would happen, which parents would apply to have the low-income credits metered out to them. That they never went on to administer that or offer that I'm aware of, and I, now Mr. Michael's writing me a note. Oh, the federal earned income credit. Okay. Oh, his note relates to the federal earned income credit, in which parents may choose to have the amount of the federal earned income credit metered out to them through their paychecks throughout the year, and so they get that in advance. I suppose a low-income parent who had earned income could choose to forego having state withholding and sort of self-meter out their credits that way throughout the year, as long as they, you know, remained within how much they had to pay during the year. But there isn't any formal program for metering out the state refundable credit.
And Supreme Grapple, and there's nothing in terms of having the payments go to a third party. I thought I remembered this, but
Mr. Representative Garofalo, there is also a provision allowing assignment of refunds for the K-12 credit, which allows an individual to assign their anticipated refund from the K-12 credit to a bank or a financial institution or a nonprofit, and they then receive an advance loan from the financial institution for the credit amount, which they can use to purchase the qualifying expenses. We have sort of sporadically gotten information from the Department of Revenue on the number of families using that program, and it's very small compared to the number who claim the credit. And the Department of Revenue encountered the same sort of thing when they proposed the metering of the state refundable credits. They did a number of town hall meetings around the state and found that most low-income parents really preferred to get one check when they filed their return, because it was generally a big check and they like to use it to make some big purchases they'd been waiting for. So they were sort of using the refundable credit as a saving program. And the same has sort of showed up with the metering of the federal earned income credit, where it's a very low percentage of qualifying families who choose to have it metered out to them through the tax year. There may be some resistance on the part of employers to doing that. We really don't know about that, but the fact is that very few people do it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, the credit has not been used by as many people as we initially thought in 1997 would use it. The initial estimates were that about 200,000 families would be income eligible and claim this credit. Actual usage has fluctuated between about 50,000 and 60,000. The average amount of the credit claimed per year has been $200 and $300 compared to a maximum per child amount of $1,000. So people are making relatively small purchases on average, relatively small expenditures for camps or other materials and equipment that qualify for this credit. And we just talked about the refund assignability. That's it. All right, then. We'll move on.
Actually, I just want to question Ms. Manzi. What about the update for the technology? As Representative Broad said, unless you're buying a five-year-old used computer on eBay, $200 isn't really keeping up with times. I mean, I know they're not, it's been $1,000, but has there been an adjustment or a proposed adjustment on purchasing for that? Because I do think that's probably, maybe for the times or for inflation, if nothing else, an adjustment can be made.
Mr. Chair, at the time the credit was enacted, that $200 limit was subject to a lot of debate. Even in 1997, that was not enough money to buy a computer.
Oh, yeah.
The proponents of the credit would have liked to have a larger amount for the computer, and this was the $200 is there as a result of budget constraints at the time. There were estimates done and proposals discussed for much, much larger amounts for the computer expenditures, and there simply wasn't enough money available in the context of the bill that was being considered to do that. And I'm not aware of there having been proposals to increase the $200 since then, either to increase it or to index it. It's remained fixed at the $200.
Fine idea. Thank you.
On page 52 of the handout, the credit for military service in the combat zone, Minnesota provides a refundable credit equal to $120 for each month of service in a designated combat zone or qualified hazardous duty area. The eligible areas are listed in your handout, and this credit was first enacted in 2006, and the credit amount was doubled in the last legislative session. The estimated revenue impact in fiscal 08 is about $1.1 million, and again, in the cost of this, for the revenue loss for this program, will simply is expected to double in fiscal 2010 because of the changes last session. One other thing, this credit is estimated about 2,660 individuals claim this credit according to the tax expenditure report.
The military service and a combat zone credit can be viewed as being in lieu of a bonus. Minnesota has paid bonuses to veterans of past military actions. Those have usually been paid some distance in time removed from the military action, whereas this credit is being paid sort of as we go. Each year we pay a credit equal to a dollar amount for each month of service in a combat zone. So it can be seen as providing some more immediate recognition for the service. The number of individuals who actually have claimed this credit hasn't met the expectations based on information we've gotten from the Department of Military Affairs and the U.S. Department of Defense as to how many people actually are serving in combat zones. That's a little bit of a mystery. It might in part be because people in combat zones have pay that's fully tax exempt at the state level anyway, so they're simply not filing return and they aren't aware that this credit exists. It's not clear if this is any more or less effective than a bonus. The thing with a bonus is that it may be 10 years or so after the military action is over, so some of the people eligible may have moved out of state. They may have died of other causes since then, and they may just simply be unaware that the opportunity is there to file and claim the bonus. So it's really uncertain as to whether this does any better than a bonus would. What is certain is that it does get the money to the people who claim it much more quickly than a bonus would.
The credit for bovine tuberculosis testing, this is again a refundable income tax credit allowed to an owner of cattle in Minnesota equal to one half of the expenses incurred to conduct TB testing on those cattle. This credit is reduced to one quarter of the expenses for corporate owners of cattle, including shareholders of an S corporation. The estimated revenue loss for the income tax portion of this credit is $100,000, and we do not have any detail on the number of individuals or taxpayers that claim this credit per year.
The bovine tuberculosis testing credit is intended to offset the cost of tuberculosis testing for affected owners of cattle, farmers or ranchers. People are aware of the bovine tuberculosis zone in the northwestern part of the state, but along with that zone comes the requirement that anyone who owns cattle anywhere in the state must have them tested for bovine TB before they can be shipped out of state. This credit is primarily going to people who are outside that bovine tuberculosis zone but elsewhere in the state and subject to these testing requirements. There are related direct spending programs from both the federal and state governments that go to the people within the zone for their testing costs and for other expenses. We're not aware of any effectiveness, no evidence on the effectiveness of this credit in meeting its objective. We assume that people who are eligible for it apply for it and claim it. It seems that it could be evaluated against whether it would be easier and simpler for people to apply to the Commissioner of Agriculture, for example, for a grant to offset these costs. Under that sort of approach, they would be reimbursed for the costs perhaps much closer in time to when they incurred them than under the tax credit approach, where, like with the other refundable credits, you have to pay for the expenses in January through December, and then you get the credit when you file your return.
Okay, on page 54 of your handout, we have a graph that just shows the trends in the revenue impact for selected income tax expenditures from 1994 to 2010. This graph just essentially shows how the cost, the growth of these tax expenditures relative to personal income. And that concludes the income tax portion of tax expenditures. Now we can move on to sales tax expenditures. And Ms. Dalton will be joining us.
Welcome, Ms. Dalton. And I understand that there's an additional handout in our packet that you're going to help explain to us as we move into the sales tax region.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research. I'll talk about the extra handout when we get to the exemption for groceries, because that's what it relates to. We're going to start on page 55 of the handout, and before we start talking about individual expenditures, we're going to kind of have a little history of the sales tax, because it's really important when you're thinking about the rationale for why certain sales tax expenditures exist. The sales tax was enacted in 1967, and it was primarily envisioned as a tax on tangible goods. Services were generally not subject to the tax. There were only four things that were non-tangible goods that were actually subject.
We can't see it right.
What? There were only four non-tangible items that were originally subject to the tax, and that was admissions for amusements, lodging, electricity, and local telephone service. And exemptions in the original law were limited to business inputs, general exemptions to government, and three things that were considered kind of necessities: food, prescription, drugs, and clothing. So when you're thinking about the sales tax exemptions that exist in our law today, they're really a product of the sales tax history. They are either services who have never been taxed or necessities that have kind of never been reexamined. A number of sales tax exemptions have no policy rationale. I mean, it's a fruit of this history and are a product of simple inertia. There are 110 explicit exemptions in the sales tax law. We are clearly not going to cover all 110 of them. In addition, there are all the services that are implicitly exempt because they are not taxable unless we explicitly tax them. So, needless to say, we are not covering all sales tax exemptions. We would be here forever. We need to talk a little bit about kind of the issue of necessity. As I said, food, prescription drugs, and clothing were initially excluded as necessities, but it's really very hard to assess the policy goal of a necessity, because it's really an inherently subjective measurement. What is a necessity? For instance, if you heat with natural gas in this state, your natural gas purchases are exempt as a necessity. However, because you are not heating with electricity, you pay sales tax on the electricity that makes your furnace run. So it's a very difficult thing to measure. To the extent that the reason we exclude necessities is to reduce the regressivity of the sales tax, then we can look at the incidence. of those exemptions to see if it really does change the receptivity. But, you know, that's not necessarily the total measure of necessity. It's also worth noting that if you're trying to make a cost-effective sales tax system, it is better to tax all or nearly all consumption expenditures and then provide a rebate to persons of low income. I mean, if that is one of your goals, is simplification and cost-effectiveness, then exemptions are not probably the best way to get to regressivity. That would a low-income rebate equal to the sales tax paid by low-income households might be a better way to actually address regressivity and measure than eliminate it, having the exemptions on the necessity.
Ms. Alton?
Yeah. Mr. Chair. To that point, Ms. Dalton, are you saying that the cost of administration would be less? Because when I think about, you know, giving rebates, I mean, there's a cost to that. You know, you got to figure out who gets it. You've got to issue a check and all of that. So is that what you're talking about? I know that in terms of being simpler, I can easily understand that. But, you know, what about the cost issue?
Ms. Elton?
Madam Chair, Representative, there are costs borne by a lot of people in administering the sales tax system. And a lot of the costs that are borne in the sales tax system aren't borne by the state. They're borne by the retailers, the people who actually have to draw the lines and figure out what is taxable and what's not taxable. There's a lot of dead weight in a sales tax system where you are not taxing most of the goods. So, yes, I mean, you're right, there are costs, administrative costs to doing a rebate. And there's also costs to the low-income families because they have to, you know, it's deferred, you know, payments and things like that. But if really it's kind of to reduce the dead weight loss, you are probably better off with a broader sales tax with a rebate system than with a sales tax system where you are exempting a lot of things and people are always having to make those decisions about is this taxable, is this not taxable.
I hear the voice of Representative Simpson somewhere in the background saying he'd like to see the dead weight as a retailer. I'm sure there's a grocery store that he could give you examples of. But Mr. Michael, to add to that question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, just to add another dimension to what Pat was saying, aside from the administrative costs, if the goal that you're seeking to achieve is to reduce the regressivity of the tax, exempting necessities is a fairly blunt way to do that because you exempt the clothing purchases not just of the poor and low income, but of the high income people. And so the approach of using a rebate or a refund is you say, we're going to tax all clothing purchases, and it's irrelevant what your income is, but then we will, when you apply for the rebate, we'll put it back only to low income people. So it's sort of a more cost effective way of reducing the regressivity of the tax because you're not exempting clothing purchases, for example, of high-income people.
Sure. Chesky?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, and we're going to hear from the Governor's 21st Century Commission report, and they're proposing expanding the sales tax base, and I think they mentioned in their report kind of a low-income offset. So you bring all these taxes on, and you do a low-income offset, and we're actually hoping to kind of see that in bill form so that we can understand how that would all work. But I'm just wondering from Ms. Dalton, you know, if you think that through and you've got all these issues for retailers and that the state is not picking up and hearing, you know, what Representative Liebling is saying. So let's say you followed the commission's recommendation and you did this. You know, you wouldn't, of course, have people saving all their receipts, you know, every time they bought everything and they're putting them in not a little shoebox, like a room, so they can prove they actually bought all that and qualify for a rebate. You would have to make some judgments based on something that in general this income tax bracket buys X amount and this income tax bracket. And there would certainly be outliers in there. I mean, because you have, you know, the multimillionaire who's like, you know, living in the little house and, you know, doesn't spend a dime. And then you have the people who are pretty low income, they're kind of blowing it all. And so you'd have to make some judgments about just in general, how credible is it to say that people on average, and we do that in the use tax now. I mean, we sort of say up to $750 or whatever, we're just going to assume you guys all buy that and you're not lawbreakers. We're just going to embed it in the tax code. So you don't have to save all your little receipts from all the things you bought in other places that you didn't count. So how would we do that? If we were going to take the 21st Century Commission Report idea here and put all these things in, or some of them or whatever, and give a, you know, you hear this all the time, give the low-income credit off. How would you actually do that, though? How would that work out? Because you don't want people saving all their receipts.
Well, and Madam Chair, you haven't seen my wife first, but Ms. Sullivan.
He doesn't want you to see that.
No.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lankowski, I would guess that we would do something very similar to what we did when we did the Ventura sales tax rebate, which is that we set up tables based on average consumption patterns for various types of filers. And you certainly could set it up so, you know, you could do that, or you could document it with receipts, which would be something that somebody who was low income that had to make a lot of consumption expenditures might choose to do the alternative. But there are, you know, you would probably set it up as some type of table.
But I would defer to Mr. Michael, you know, if there's a better way.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the Chair Lankowski.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, Ms. Dalton, just because I do think we're going to get into that with the 21st century. Can you provide that later to the whole committee? Because I'm remembering that now, because there was this whole debate on rebating the boatload of money. I think that's what it was called then. Those are the days. And it was first proposed as an income tax rebate, and then everybody in the tax committee bipartisanly sort of figured out that unless you're in the income tax system, you weren't going to get that rebate. Yet you, as a Minnesotan, were paying. Like, say you're a senior citizen, you didn't have income, you weren't going to qualify, but, you know, seniors buy a lot of stuff. So it was changed to a sales tax rebate mechanism. Can you bring us that, how that helped played out? So this, we can begin to look at that, how that would actually work, just at a different date, because I'm kind of curious. That was quite a while ago.
Ms. Dalton or Mr. Michael or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lankowski, we can sure pull out there actually three different schedules. And I think the idea generally would be to look at the consumer expenditure survey and estimate by, you know, income category roughly what people spend on sales tax. And I guess my advice would be to not allow them to use receipts to show that they had purchased a lot more, both because that would be expensive, and two, you get distortions when you have that, because economists would generally say it's better to look at people's permanent incomes to see whether they're, you know, what income bracket they fit into. So over a period of time, some people's income fluctuates quite a bit, just because of the nature of their employment or the, you know, their place in their life cycle. And if you've got somebody who's spending a fair amount in one year that's disproportionate to their income, that likely reflects the difference in permanent income and not their, you know, and we can't measure this or provide the rebate based on permanent income. So you don't want somebody who's, you know, okay, they, you know, they decided, one of the spouses of a married couple decided to go back to school for a year to get a graduate degree or something like that, but their spending pattern hasn't changed. And so then if you give them a rebate based on that, or somebody has saved up a bunch of money to buy something big, and so you give them a rebate in that year. My advice is generally not to let people keep their receipts and claim a bigger amount.
Madam Chair?
I'm sorry, but I just can't resist. So we're trying to think that through. So did the idea of Governor Ventura saying, you know, here's a minimum rebate you get, but if you can prove you bought something bigger, you can have more? Was that all roped up in the big toys and the boats? Do you remember all that with Governor Ventura? Is that where that came from? Because there were some of those arguments made that, you know, if I went and bought a big boat or a big, you know, Winnebago that I've been saving, I kind of remember this now. I was a freshman that year, and it was all very intriguing as we spent a lot of time on things like big toys.
And I think the governor himself is very intriguing, right, Mr. Michael?
Yes.
Yeah, that does have a big place.
That was perfect, because he's
funny. Yeah. Well, Chair, Representative Lenchefsky, I think there was a different purpose behind the sales tax rebate than this type of sales tax rebate, which would be targeted just to reduce the regressivity of the tax, whereas the goal with the Ventura rebate was across the entire income spectrum to try to give back to people a portion of their sales tax, the sales tax that they paid.
But Mr. Michael, maybe on the same point, the example I'm maybe thinking of, like an either-or situation when you file your taxes, if you give away clothing to Goodwill, without itemization, it's, what, $500, but if you want to go above that amount, then you have to have an actual amount. So it's an either-or system, or I guess that's more of a federal tax, but if that type of system would be still just as cluttered and saving receipts again.
Mr. Chair, that was sort of the Ventura rebate system, as I recall, at least for some taxpayers. We allowed them to come in and prove that they had actually spent more to give them back, actually. Yeah. And part of that was tied up in that we wanted to make sure that the federal government would not tax these rebates as income.
Right.
And, you know, those features helped us convince the IRS that it really was a sales tax rebate.
Right. You can take the base or you can go ahead and do your homework. And we've got Representative Garofalo next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How do we do the fuel credit right now for low-income folks?
Ms. Dalton?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, Ms. Templeton and I were actually, we were anticipating that. I believe that we actually looked at consumer expenditure survey data to get some average gas purchase information to use to develop that credit as well.
Follow up, Mr. Garofalo.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. It's Mr. Chairman, not Madam Chairman.
I'm listening.
Yeah, well, there's no receipts, though, right? There's none of that. Or
Representative Eastland.
Sure. How does expanding the sales tax to broader, I mean, to everything, you know, to necessity, everything, how does that affect the stability of the gross receipts that the state gets from the sales tax?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, it depends on what we include and expand the sales tax base to. But clearly, the more consumption that we tax, the more stable it is going to be. Generally, the common wisdom is the narrower the base, the more variation you're going to have over the course of the business cycle. Clearly, if we tax groceries, we're going to make the sales tax more stable. If you tax necessities, things that people will buy regardless of what their income is, you're going to make the sales tax base more stable. If you only expand it to luxury goods, you may actually increase the instability of the sales tax base.
Maybe this is kind of just an incremental kind of thing. I'm just thinking if there's a credit for low income for a sales tax credit that they've received, and if the economy kind of moves around, and so in good times we're collecting a lot more sales tax, and in bad times we're collecting less sales tax, and that credit stays the same. I guess I'm just how does that work?
Mr. Michael, Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, it would depend upon how the credit is set up. I think normally if we were in the business of designing that credit now, chances are you would want to index the parameters of it for inflation so it would keep pace with the price level changes. But basically, usually people spend more because their income rises. And so if their income rises, they may go higher in the credit parameter and get a bigger credit as a result of that, or maybe their income will increase so much that they're high enough income that they don't qualify for the low-income credit. So it's sort of not exactly obvious how that's going to intersect with the cost of the credit. But I think you'd want to index the parameters of the credit for inflation so it keeps pace with price changes.
And the initiator of the conversation, Representative Rubley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to follow up a little bit on Representative Lenchefsky's remarks. I mean, first of all, I have to say that the whole issue about rebates and that whole argument about the rebates, that was kind of what made me start paying attention to what was going on here at the Capitol. That's the first time I've... Because there was all that argument about who should get the money, and all this money was spent sending out the money, and I was at home going, don't the schools need money? Why are they mailing me this check and spending all this money to do it? So that got me interested and started paying attention to what the state was doing. So, you know, just a little warning there, I guess. And then I was thinking, too, that, you know, maybe the real way to do this, and I don't know, I'm just kind of throwing this out there, you know, rather than thinking about doing rebates, and I really think one of the things we really need to do is simplify our tax system. I think it's a source of great frustration in Minnesotans that it's so hard to understand this stuff. And I mean, I tell my constituents, I come here in the second term, I'm on the tax committee, and I still don't understand this stuff, you know. And so I know they don't understand it. So what about just, you know, if we were going to expand sales tax greatly, and I'm not saying I'm in favor of that at this point, but if we were to do it, maybe the way to make up for it is just to make our income tax a whole lot more progressive, to so that we, you know, I mean, really do it in one place so that people can really see that, you know, and make up for all this stuff within the system that we have, instead of, you know, trying to mail checks to people and figure all that out. I mean, just an idea.
And I don't know if we have one other question, and maybe we can blame Governor Ventura for lots of things, and Representative Liebling, but now we've got another one to the list. Representative Reed had a question or a comment along these lines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. It occurs to me that I had a conversation a couple years ago with somebody that told me that Florida had a tax holiday, and I want to say for going back to school, for I think on the social system. So I'm just wondering if you would comment on the policy pros and cons of that. It seems like it would be a nightmare for the retailers, but since we're in this discussion, I would like your thoughts.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative, sales tax holidays are a nightmare. There are a number of states who provide them, particularly the back-to-school sales tax holidays are very common in a number of states. New York provides one, Florida provides one, Texas provides one. Part of the problems, you're right, I mean, part of the problems are what's eligible for the holiday. You know, and what's that eligible for? Again, it's the whole administrative deadweight cost of, you know, just trying to do it. But then there's also issues of do you actually change behavior? And it's not clear that you've actually changed purchases so much as you've changed timing of purchases. And so you may actually reduce the amount of revenue going to the state without actually having changed anybody's purchase behavior.
Follow-up, Representative Reed? And members, we have about 4 or 5 minutes left, and I think we're still on the first page of the sales tax, a hot topic, especially this year. So if we don't finish on time, which I don't think we will, make sure and keep your packets, keep the handout in your packets for the next meeting. Ms. Alton, if you want to get into page 56.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that there's three basic things that we'll talk about when we're talking about sales tax exemptions. Whether this makes the sales tax regressive, more regressive or less regressive, tax pyramiding. Mr. Michael talked about that early on. We don't look at most of the business exemptions here because we are assuming you do not want to increase tax pyramiding, so we are not exempt looking at those exemptions. And finally, we're going to be talking a little bit about the ease of compliance and administration.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the exemption for clothing and wearing apparel. As we all know, clothing is excluded from the sales tax base. The exemption does not apply to furs, jewelry, handbags, billfolds, sports clothing sold exclusively for sporting activities, or work-related safety items. The revenue loss reported in the 2008 report is $361.9 million. Again, I should note that this is, if such a clothing is added to the sales tax base, the revenue loss would be a little bit less because the estimate that was put together in the 2008 expenditure report is based on an older financial forecast.
May I ask Ms. Templin, and maybe this is to Ms. Dalton's point about the 110 exemptions making no sense, but why we picked the inner and outer footwear, the headgear, gloves, mittens, but the one that really I'm interested in is the clothing sold exclusively for the use of any sporting good or activity. How do we prove that?
Mr. Chair, the definition of clothing that we currently have is the definition that was developed by the Streamline Sales Tax Agreement. We were actually very fortunate in that we had a big hand in developing that definition, so this really mirrored like 99% of how we tax clothing, with the exception of fur, which they now mirror for us, so we now have the fur tax. They have a two-page definition of what's included and what's excluded, and we just adopted their definition.
Chairman Chesky?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Dalton is very modest, and she has been one of the leaders in this whole FSTA for the state and getting Minnesota out there early. And just, did you get gloves and mittens in there for Minnesotans personally, or can we just ask? Because I'm sure those southern states weren't worrying about gloves and mittens, so maybe how did that get in there?
Does Dalton, are you responsible for warm fingers and heads around the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't think I was explicitly, had anything to do with the gloves and mittens. However, I did get to take out of our sales tax definition. At one point, when we defined clothing in this state, we said, silverware is not clothing. Don't ask me why. And I'm very happy to say silverware is not, a reference to this definition of clothing.
Maybe it has something to do with the Lewis Fest feed, I don't know. Well, and as we're doing exemptions, Madam Chair, if this would be a good place to stop, as I'm sure there would be a lot of other members in the committee before we get to groceries. We'll continue on, technically I think we're still on page 57, so we'll pick up where we were and continue on to the next exciting topic, which is exemption of groceries. Thank you, members. Meeting adjourned.